This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking with Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at UND and the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which you will hear this Sunday at 5 Central right here on this Prairie Public Network. And Jack, this month your question is, does accepting the theory of evolution mean there is no meaning of life? Why did you pick this question?
I like the small, unimportant questions. I like the irrelevant things. You know, I came across this book about the topic, and I thought it was fascinating because evolution is such a bugaboo, if people still use that expression, a bugaboo in today's culture. Evolution has so many complicated meanings to it, right? Is it anti-religion? Is it the sign of scientific truth? But the ultimate question that I think we can ask after is it true is, what are the consequences of it? There are lots of people who think that if we are evolved from monkeys, as they will say, then life has no meaning and no purpose, and there's no right and wrong. And I don't know. As a philosopher, that doesn't sit well with me, and so I wanted to dive right in.
So why did you want to talk to Michael Roos about it? Michael is a professor and director of the History and Philosophy of Science program at Florida State University.
Michael is one of these guys who I can't believe exists. He's written over 50 books. He has this overall sense of history and science in particular and philosophy that is extraordinary. And so who else are you going to talk to about the meaning of life than someone who has a massively expansive view of the history of thought and ideas, and who can talk equally well about science? So it's not just, right, literature and philosophy and the great questions that we sort of relegate the meaning questions to, but it's also about the facts of the universe and scientific experimentation. And so I can't think of a better guest than Michael to engage in what may be among the hardest questions I've asked in the last 10 years.
I was really intrigued by the name of the program, though, and let's expand on that a bit. What is the purpose of a History and Philosophy of Science program?
Well, so people tend to think of science incorrectly, in my point of view, right? We think that science is only the latest conclusion. So eggs are bad for you. Okay, we won't eat them. Eggs are good for you. Okay, well, science was wrong. Eggs are sometimes bad for you, sometimes good for you. These people don't know anything, right? And that's how we think of science. We think of science as telling us facts that we can follow. But science has a history, and what makes science interesting is the debates and the discourses that travel throughout history to help us figure out not the truth, but the best truth we have so far, the most likely conclusion we have so far. And so when we talk about the history of and philosophy of science, we're talking about two different things. First, we're talking about the great minds like Copernicus and Isaac Newton who changed things along the way. But we're also talking about how we ask those questions. So one of the things, for example, that Michael and I talked about is that up until the Renaissance, the basic idea of the universe was that we thought of the world as an organism, as a living being. But then when people started inventing mechanical clocks, we changed the root metaphor to the universe as a machine, as a clockwork. Now, how you think about the universe is going to be really different. If you think of it as an organism, it's alive, it grows, it has its own meaning and its own purpose. If you think about it as a machine, it's just a tool, and we impose all of our meaning and value on it. When you talk about the history and philosophy of science, you get to talk about changes like that. And when you talk about changes like that, you get to see how and why we know the things that we do and how and why we don't know the things that we don't.
So is this ultimately a discussion about evolution versus creation with Dr. Roos?
It's not. It could have been that. And he has some discussion of Christianity in his book. But what it really becomes a discussion about is the meaning in our life and how we want to look for meaning in the systems. And there are two systems on the table. One is a system in which we are created by God, and God has a purpose for us, and God has a blueprint for us, and God declares what's good and what's not, and what's valuable and what's not. You can call that creationism, but it's certainly much more complex than that. And the other system on the table is the evolutionary system, where the system follows its own rules, where there is random mutation that lead to what Darwin called natural selection, or the creatures that survive the competition because they can live better in the world. And so since it's not just do you believe in creationism and do you believe in evolution, but since it's the supporting framework, that idea or theory that surrounds the claim of creation or the claim of evolution, then we get to have really interesting, subtle, and important conversations that are a lot more nuanced than what you hear the politicians arguing about or the talking heads argue about in the news programs.
Well, religions over the centuries have adapted to scientific findings. You mentioned Copernicus and others, and their findings have evolved over the centuries. So natural selection, Darwin's theory, came along with a belief in a designer. The designer can sort of throw the pieces out there and they can naturally select themselves, can't they?
Sure. Well, look, so there's nothing in Darwin, and Michael makes it very clear, there's nothing in Darwin that demands atheism, right? You can create a god, or you can have a belief in a god that creates an evolutionary system. That's not a problem. The reason why God disappears from the system is that there's no rhyme and reason to the progress. So originally, the early theories of evolution, and one example is a scientist named Lamarck, they thought that there was a principle that the universe was following, and each generation, so to speak, was closer to that goal. But it was all planned out in advance. And that's a God-driven system, or at least a principle-driven system. What Darwin does is say, we don't know what's going to happen in the next generation. What we do know is that there are scarce resources, that there are ways to survive, there are ways to reproduce that are better than others. And the creatures that go on to the next generation are the creatures that, by the accidents of mutation, by the accidents of birth, work better. Now, because it's an accident, because it's a scrambling around in the dark, because the conclusion is not established in advance, you don't have a god, or at least you don't need a god. And that leads us to ask, well, okay, then what is valuable, what is meaningful to us? If there is no God, how can I say that my life is better other than I survived, I reproduced? Even you can't even say I'm not in pain, because how do we know that pain isn't good, right? You're lost without that. And so what he wants to do is help us be unlost, if that's a word.
Okay. Well, if we follow our natural curiosity and our experimentation, and because of that, we come across things we call discoveries. Aren't we, in effect, boosting our own evolution? And doesn't that process, that curiosity and discovery, make us capable of things that we once thought were godlike?
It depends what you mean by evolution. If what you mean by evolution is that society progresses and we learn more things and we are incrementally better by some standard of better, then yes. But if what you're talking about is Darwinian natural selection, then first of all, human beings haven't really evolved in something like a million years. But more important than that, you can't force the changes. You can't force things. So let me give a simple example that we didn't talk about. About 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with a bulging disc in my lower back. It was very, very painful. I thought I was going to have surgery. Thankfully, I found other ways to deal with it. It turns out that this injury is the injury of truck drivers and secretaries, as the surgeon told me. And it's for people who sit all the time. Human beings are not designed to sit. If we had evolved over the last 1,000 years or even 200 years, then we would be creatures who would sit comfortably and our bodies would work well at desks, in cubicles, in cars and buses and trucks. But they don't, because we have the body of the Homo sapien. We have the body of the creature who hunters and gathers from 10,000 years ago. And so our body revolts, and my body hurts because I'm a professor and I sit a lot. If we could force evolution, we would make our kids' backs better because we sit in a desk. And we can't do that. All we can do is, in some instances, surgery. In my instance, Pilates. And you've never heard me say this, but I am an evangelical when it comes to Pilates. I can literally walk because of Pilates. And that has nothing to do with evolution, but it has to do with the creative intellectual ability to figure out how to deal with the world because our bodies won't evolve.
Well, I had the surgery, and so I'll be evangelical about that. But 10,000 years ago, a lot of things could kill you before you got to the age of 40. And by the time you got to the age of 40, old age might have killed you. So we have progressed beyond that.
We have progressed beyond that, and we are better off in society. But the same things can still kill us. We just know how to get rid of those same things. So have we evolved to be immune to measles? We have not. We have inoculations, right? Have we evolved to fly across the ocean and see the great works of art in the Louvre? No, we've invented airplanes. So Michael is not suggesting, and I'm not suggesting, that we don't get better, we don't get smarter, we don't get technologically more advanced. We aren't good at adapting to our world in that sense. But when we take the evolutionary perspective, none of that happens in a time frame that is going to be meaningful to any of us. It may be meaningful in a million years. Maybe in 100,000 years, we won't have bulging discs. I don't know. I can't say. But again, the consequence of this discussion is that if we can't do this, then is the meaning that we impose on ourselves, or the meaning that we find, is it just artificial because it's disconnected from nature, or is it artificial because it's disconnected from God? And so the question that Michael wants to ask is, can we recover a sense of the meaning of life and still accept what he regards as the truth, which is evolution as currently understood?
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. You'll hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on this radio network. And the question this month is, does accepting the theory of evolution mean there is no meaning of life? Jack, I looked up, as you mentioned, Michael Ruse is well-published. He's written a lot of stuff, and he's a well-known atheist. But he's at odds with other people who kind of share his rough belief, which he calls new atheists. What is a new atheist, and what distinction should we make from this?
So the new atheists are people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who get a lot of attention, or Hitchens did when he was alive, get a lot of attention not only arguing for a scientific worldview, but also for really denigrating religion. Dawkins in particular is really nasty, and he has a very famous book, which I read and have a bunch of issues with, called The God Delusion. And he basically argues that religion and belief in God is not just false, but it's delusional. And what Michael wants to do is different than that. Michael is not at all interested in denigrating religion. He's not a believer, and he has arguments as to why he doesn't believe Christianity in particular, and there's some of that in the book. But he does believe that you can reconcile religion and science in ways that are meaningful and important. He doesn't want to say that what he regards as false beliefs of religion should be regarded as superior or equal to the what he argues are the true claims of science. But he does think that religion gives people meaning, and he does think that religion is important, and he does think that it's a personal choice, and he does think that religion plays a tremendously important role in the history and philosophy of science and discovery. And so one of the things that I like about him is that while he is very opinionated and while he is very open about those opinions, he's not interested in belittling other approaches. He's only interested in trying to give a system that is going to make people feel satisfied with what they can hold on to and what's meaningful to them.
Well, Mr. Philosopher, is the fundamental difference between a believer's view and an atheist's view that when science is parsed to its finest, a mystery will remain that is unsolvable by a human.
You know, there are ineffable elements of the human experience. It may be the case that we never know all of the answers. There may be things that science can't explain. We don't know. We just have to keep trying, right? It's the same thing with the cure of cancer. We don't have a cure for cancer, but it doesn't mean we're not going to try. We don't have all the answers about the universe, about the nature of if there's an afterlife. We don't know these things. We have commitments. We have beliefs. We have insights. We have intuitions, but we don't know. What a philosopher does, what a scientist does, what pretty much anyone who is interested in inquiry, even if that inquiry takes the form of art or literature or music, says is we got to try. We got to figure it out. So I'm really reluctant to say we can't do anything. What I want to say is we try, we fail. We try, we fail. Maybe we get closer. Maybe we get closer. And maybe not my daughter or my grandchild or three generations, but maybe 5, 10, 20 generations, we will have deep, great answers, or maybe we won't. Maybe that unknowability is an important part of the human experience. I'm not sure, but I'm having a good career figuring it out.
Well, I have yet to see a circle of squirrels on the lawn having a Socratic discussion. So I'm thinking there is this, you know, miracle at this point to most of us about what it is that happens in our heads. We're thinking. We're asking questions. You're a philosopher. Your life is all questions. So is this uniquely human, what we're doing?
So I'm going to be a pain in the butt for a second and be a real philosopher here. So when you described human beings as having this what gets called metacognition, the ability to think about our own thinking, mm-hmm. you used the term miracle.
Yeah.
And what Michael Ruse is going to say and what others are going to say is, and actually famously David Hume in the 18th century said is, that's not a miracle. That's the most natural thing of all. It's evolutionary that we've developed this metacognition. A miracle is something that's outside of nature. A miracle is something that has no explanation. And we have explanations for a lot of these things, including the ability to think about our own thoughts. A couple years ago, we had an episode with Valerius Geist where he offered a evolutionary explanation for why people became artists. So the first part is it's not a miracle. But the second part is, yes, it appears that human beings are unique in that we appear to be the only animals who are able to have these thoughts about our own thinking, that we're the only animals who don't just live in the moment and don't just operate on certain kinds of instinct. Now, whether that's ultimately true or not remains to be seen. What has happened over the last 50 years in particular is that we've discovered that human beings aren't quite as different as we used to think. Philosophers used to think what makes an animal different from a human is that human beings can reason, animals can't, period. But now we know that dolphins, for example, engage in some sort of higher order reasoning. We know that chimpanzees engage in all sorts of social behaviors and rule following. We know that it's more of a spectrum rather than a black and white. But we do know, or as far as there is evidence, we are committed to the idea that humans are unique in this respect. And that means that the human experience is something different and worth exploring.
Okay. So philosophy is trying to always reconcile life with what does it all mean?
That's absolutely right. And sometimes it's in the background and we don't talk about it, but sometimes it's right in our faces. And that's what happened in this episode of Why. And it was fun and intense. And Michael is a jovial, as he reminded us, Englishman several times. And it's worth a listen because he's just a fun, funny guy who loves what he does. And his enthusiasm really came out in the conversation.
The question this month is, does accepting the theory of evolution mean there is no meaning of life? You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein is the host. Thanks for being with us today, Jack.
Thank you, Doug. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up next on Main Street, another poet profile from Studio 47.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to President Jefferson. We talk to him about the formation of the government of the United States.
And we hear from Mr. Jefferson the social compact theory that when you're alone, you're an absolute sovereign. When you join other people in the community, you have to negotiate what is for the Commonwealth and what part of your natural rights you get to keep unadjusted by government.
I did my best to talk to Mr. Jefferson about the great advantages Americans have today and pointed to he and his compatriots as the source of many of those.
But Jefferson, like all the Founding Fathers, worried that great comfort and luxury would put us to sleep and we would cease to be eternally vigilant, and that's when mischief in the name of Alexander Hamilton starts to creep in.
And of course you remind us that any nation who expects to be
ignorant and free expects what never has been and never can be in a state of civilization.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. November is Native American Heritage Month. So for this week's poetry from Studio 47, Patrick Hicks discusses a Native American poet.
Today's poet is Virginia Driving Hawk Snavey. She was born on February 21st, 1933, on the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and she is a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. Driving Hawk attended St. Mary's School for Indian Girls before studying at South Dakota State University, where she received her B.A. and M.A. It was also at South Dakota State where she met her husband. When they began to start a family, she realized that more books needed to be available that showed Native American culture in a positive light. She wanted to dispel negative images and show Lakota culture in a positive light. As she said in one interview, "I write from my own experience and about Native Americans I've known all my life. The characters are believable children who live on modern-day reservations." Driving Hawk Snavey was an English teacher and counselor in Rapid City, as well as a teacher at the Flandreau Indian School for four decades. She has written many books for both children and adults, including Jimmy Yellowhawk, Dancing Teepees, The Trickster and the Troll, The Christmas Coat, Memories of My Sioux Childhood, and Grandpa Was a Cowboy and an Indian. She has won the Spirit of Crazy Horse Award, the North American Indian Prose Award, the Author Illustrator Human and Civil Rights Award, and also the National Humanities Medal. Today's poem is Sacred Colors. The cardinal directions are familiar to anyone that has consulted a compass, north, south, east, west. In Lakota culture, the white buffalo calf woman came to earth and gave the people the four winds, or the four directions. Each direction has a specific color and a specific meaning attached to it. This is represented as a circle with a cross in the middle, which binds the world together. The four colors are yellow, red, black, and white. Anyone that has spent any time in South Dakota will immediately recognize this powerful and sacred symbol. It is a part of the cultural and spiritual landscape. And so, this is Sacred Colors by Virginia Driving Hawk Snavey. Yellow is the east, the season of spring. Golden rays of the rising sun bring light and life to a new day. Red is the south, warm summer, the growing time when life is good in the noon of day. Black is the west, the season of autumn's falling leaves and spirits follow the setting sun. White is the north, snow, the hardships of long life give strength. It is the color of wise grandma's hair.
That's Patrick Hicks, writer in residence at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. All the poems are recorded at Augustana. Poetry from Studio 47 is produced by Peter Folliard. Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson reviews the week's big stories, and Matt Olin reviews another new movie. This week, it's The Lighthouse. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue has approved a secretarial disaster designation for 47 of North Dakota's 53 counties, making assistance available to farmers and ranchers dealing with the impacts of an early blizzard and abnormally wet fall. Governor Doug Burgum submitted a request to Perdue last Friday. Today's announcement was made as USDA Undersecretary Bill Northey met with farmers in Argusville to discuss the severe harvest situation and to get a firsthand look at damages from the early blizzard, record fall rain, flooding, and cold temperatures that have delayed harvest, caused hundreds of millions of dollars in crop losses, and put billions more at risk. Governor Tim Walz has also asked the federal government to declare a dozen counties in northwestern Minnesota an agriculture disaster area as a result of the severe weather.
That's not a fix. It's not an instant fix. It might provide some of that safety net to kind of soften the blow a little bit, but I'm concerned for next year.
And call it Olmstead 2.0. It's a change in the role of North Dakota's Olmstead Commission. Leslie Bonkin-Oliver is a co-chair.
The Olmstead decision requires what's called the community integration mandate.
And that means?
Anyone with a disability, anyone who falls within the Americans with Disabilities Act, must be served by the state or local municipal governments in the community, if at all possible, based on the individual's personal choice, resources of the government entity, and looking at availability of resources, period.
Oliver says when the commission was first created, it was given authority to oversee how North Dakota is meeting the standards laid out by the federal courts. But she says the commission will now play more of an advisory role. And Oliver says the legislature has funded a full-time position located within the state's protection and advocacy office.
To support the work of the commission and to provide education, training, outreach, information, and referral to individuals who have questions or need information about Olmstead.
Oliver says North Dakota has made a lot of progress in making sure people with disabilities have the ability to stay in their communities. She says there is more work to be done. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This week on Away with Words, we'll talk about all kinds of language, including body language.
So I wanted to ask a little bit about anachronistic gestures. I know that's not necessarily your total bailiwick, but it's a part of communication and it just fascinates me. You know, do you bite your thumb at me, sir?
That's the last draw, like gunslingers in the Wild West.
Join us.
Some bets were made, and here I am on the phone with you.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Well, there's that wire machine. Time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us every Friday from our studio in Bismarck to look at the week's news in review. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Doug.
Well, that big story that we talked about last week is still a big story. High runoff continues in the upper Missouri basin.
It does. I mean, this is almost record-level runoff. And the Corps of Engineers is trying to get as much water out of the upstream reservoirs as possible. So they're keeping the releases high. Normally, about this time of year, as I've been told by some people who watch these things, State Water Commission, normally it's about 11,000 CFS coming out of Garrison. We're at 44,000 or 43,000 today.
Wow. And, of course, this has ramifications downstream.
It does, because you've got the chain of dams, too, and you've got high water in some of the tributaries, especially the James River, which flows through in both North and South Dakota. And there's a lot of concern among the entire basin of just how much water is in the basin right now.
Well, in your story, you say the Corps is predicting flooding along the James River in both Dakotas.
Absolutely. And there's been flooding already this fall. And according to the hydrologists, it's so wet in the region that they do expect the James to have some flooding next year.
And now there's another potential winter storm that everybody's looking at that could drop a lot of moisture.
Right, and I can update that a little bit because I talked to the National Weather Service this morning. It looks like most of the moisture is going to fall in the mountains. That's good news and that's bad news. It's good news because it doesn't affect the runoff right now. It's bad news. It's going to affect the runoff in spring.
Yeah, and spring runoff is, I guess, where the real concern is at
it
this
is.
Point. Meanwhile, around all of this wet stuff, including difficulties getting into farm fields, Governor Burgum has issued an hours of service waiver to haulers of propane, diesel, and gasoline.
Right. Propane, especially because that's used for grain drying. Diesel, because farmers using diesel in the fields. And gasoline, because, hey, if you're hauling a lot of propane and diesel, gasoline might suffer, supplies might suffer. So he said, now we'll do this for 30 days, and it's matching what other states in the region have done.
It's, interesting to think that we're into November and the harvest is still on.
I know, and a lot of people – I was told by several people who were traveling the southern half of the state that there were combines in the field this week.
Yeah.
And that's unusual.
Well, this issue in general, though, is kind of intriguing because the hours of service waiver, that hours of service thing, is a safety measure.
It is. But, you know, they're weighing safety versus the needs out there.
And that is, we're talking about truck drivers who might be working too long.
Right.
And their awakeness might
right.
be somewhat suspect on occasion.
Yeah, and this is not unusual that this has been done in these terms where you're wondering about diesel fuel supplies or propane supplies. And basically, a lot of the upper Midwest states have done this.
Well, let's move on to the next big story of the week, as this one, I think, was intriguing. The Commerce Department, the State Commerce Department audit was debated, and this looked to be kind of a squabble in the family.
It is a kind of a squabble in the family because, of course, Republicans control most of everything. And the auditor issued a report about some money that should have been charged to the last biennium, 1719, but was charged in the 1921 biennium. And he is saying that based on state law, he has to automatically turn that over to the Attorney General's office for investigation for potential criminal activity. Well, the Attorney General, having a conflict because he's an elected official and Commerce is a cabinet agency in state government, he turns it over to the South Dakota Bureau of Criminal Investigation.
That's
South
intriguing.
Department. Yes.
And that's because of that conflict of interest thing. So we go south of the border and say, here, it's your problem now.
Right. But that happens a lot
okay.
is that, you know, if somebody's going to prosecute this, it will not be the Attorney General's office who's going to prosecute because the Attorney General is the lawyer for the governor and the governor appoints the director of commerce. So that's how intertwined things are.
And the interesting thing here also is that this looks like a technicality. So
it does.
You've got people saying, why did you do this to Josh Gallion, the auditor, and Michelle Comer, who heads the Commerce Department, is saying this has affected morale. And you've got a powerful politician, Mike Nathy of Bismarck, questioning the auditor's motives. It's interesting.
It is a completely interesting story, and I knew it was going to be that way. That's why I asked my friends in Fargo to do the noon news that day, because I knew it was going to be tied up with this. And there's a lot of dynamics at play. Remember back to the session where some legislators had passed that bill that the auditor had to come to that Legislative Audit and Fiscal Review Committee to talk about audits he was going to do, and especially performance audits, and get the blessing of the committee. Well, there's an attorney general's opinion saying that's probably not a constitutional and that the auditor, being an independently elected person, can do audits. I mean, this thing is very complicated and it's a very interesting exercise in how government works.
And it's a reminder that these personalities may clash.
They do. And in this case, they do. There are some who will tell you that the auditor is really doing a narrow interpretation of state law. And there are others who are saying the auditor is doing his job saying, hey, this needs to be investigated in case. So there are a lot of people in both camps.
Okay. Just a while ago today, you reported that there's a wind farm repowering decision that has been delayed. And it's an intriguing story here.
Now, it's interesting because we all thought that was going to sail through the Public Service Commission because you're not talking about reciting things. You're just putting larger blades on the towers and then larger generators on the towers. Well, Commissioner Randy Crispin said, wait a second, there's a problem here because that has been reported. It's been widely reported. And we reported as well, is that there seems to be, you know, some congestion developing on the power grids because
yes.
there's a lot of wind coming on and there's no room because of transmission. So if you're going to increase more megawatts coming out of wind farms, where's the power going to go? And he was trying to say, well, slow this down for just a second. But in Public Service Commission has authority on siting. And the legislature passed this footprint law. So if you put up a wind farm and you may have a name capacity in the wind farm, you really wouldn't necessarily have to come back and say we're going to up it a little bit more, more production from a wind farm. But they went to the Public Service Commission and asked that the earlier agreement where they had a nameplate specification of how much is going to be generated, they wanted that out based on the footprint law. And Commissioner Randy Crispin said there's a bit of a conflict there because it's also a requirement that the Public Service Commission needs to practice orderly development. So this is how complicated things get. And it's fascinating. It's going to be a fascinating story to follow.
Well, your story, and I'm going to quote, this is from Julie Fedorchik, we're seeing this in other facilities such as pipelines where they're expanding beyond their capacity contemplated in the original filing. They're using this procedure established in law, this footprint thing, because they're already on the site and now they're just expanding the capacity that that site allows them.
And that has been used especially for gas plants who have gone from like 50 million cubic feet to 100 million cubic feet to 150 million cubic feet without having to re-site the plant. Now, Dakota Access is a different story. You're wondering about that because
yes.
Dakota Access is going to expand from about 500,000, 600,000 barrels to 1.1 million barrels capacity. Why that is under the commission jurisdiction is because they want to build these compressor stations in Emmons County, which were not part of the original footprint of the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's why there has to be a hearing in Linton next week.
Those are new sightings, yeah.
That's a new site, yes.
Let's move on to another story that has been in the news for a long time now and apparently will be for a while yet. The Supreme Court hears an appeal of the Davis Refinery's construction permit from the DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality.
Right. And what has happened is this group called the National Parks Conservation Service has appealed the decision, saying that the DEQ did not do enough due diligence in terms of preventing pollution. Well, DEQ says what they've got now at the Davis Refinery is going to be state-of-the-art in terms of reducing pollution. And so the Supreme Court has been asked to weigh in. Did the DEQ do its due diligence when it granted the permit, or does it have to go back? And the real concern that the Conservation Service has with the parks is that this is being built very close to Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
Yeah, it's that viewshed issue, isn't it?
Viewshed issue and also the pollution issue.
Okay. And there's another hearing coming up?
Next week, and this has to do with the siting of the plant. The Public Service Commission basically said it did not have the authority to site the plant because it came in at 49,500 barrels a day. The siting criteria as set by the legislature is 50,000. Mm-hmm. Now, the opponents of the refinery are saying, wait a second, because they originally proposed 27,500 as a phase one and then immediately announced a phase two, then ratcheted back. And they think once they get the permit, they're going to go, a lot bigger. And they said the Public Service Commission should have been involved in siting that.
All right. So stay tuned.
Oh, yes.
Early this week on Monday, you had a story that was headlined, The Study of Bakken and Three Forks Natural Gas Liquids Has Been Approved.
We've talked about that. How does the makeup of the natural gas liquids change over the life of an oil well? That's what they want to find out because it will drive things like bringing petrochemicals to North Dakota if it makes major changes, or it's going to make a change in gathering facilities and gas processing facilities. So the Pipeline Authority Director, Justin Kringstad, wants the EERC in Grand Forks to do a study to see how is this going to change over time. Is it going to be more NGLs, less NGLs, more regular natural gas, less regular gas, and how this is going to affect infrastructure divisions going forward?
Well, let's get to the search committees that have been urged to look at diversity in finding candidates for college presidents in North Dakota. You filed that on Monday as well.
I did, and when I attended the meeting of the Bismarck State College Search Committee, Chancellor Mark Hagerot made that as a challenge to that committee, saying, please look at diversity of candidates. And if you look at UND's final six, it's five men, one woman. Mm-hmm. So now BSC has been asked to look at it, and BSC is doing an internal search. And the issue is who's going to apply. And they're just basically sending out a note saying we're encouraging everybody to apply.
Okay, so at this point there are three higher education institutions in the state? UND and Dickinson State
is now looking because the current president is retiring at the end of the year.
Okay. So a fair amount of turnover.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there are 11 colleges and universities in the state. But at this point, as you point out, no president on those campuses is a woman. It has been in the past, but not now.
Right. And that was Tisa Mason at Valley City State University, who was the last woman president of the system. And now the 11 colleges are all headed by men. And there's some concern, and I understand the concern, too, that we should try to attract women.
Finally, the new Blue Book is out.
Yes. And that was a fun ceremony.
That is a wonderful resource, incidentally.
It's a great resource, and I've got them back to 1979 in my newsroom because I find them very handy when I need to look up who ran for what in the 50s or 60s, just to do some historical context things.
And the Blue Book, as you remind us, is published every 2 years by the Secretary of State. Lots of facts and figures about North Dakota. So.
Right, and this time aviation is a key component.
All right. Well, we check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court will take up the DACA case next week, testing the Trump administration's policy on immigration. And next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll talk to two of the lawyers arguing before the court.
This is a rule of law case involving hundreds of thousands of individuals who will be hurt by an abrupt and unjustified change in policy.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
That's coming up tomorrow at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean, and this week, Matt, you went to one that's kind of dark and murky and stormy and troubling.
The Lighthouse, directed by Robert Eggers, who gave us The Witch 3 years ago, which is a wonderful black and white film set in the 1600s in America dealing with witches. Now he again shoots a black and white film, this in an aspect ratio that's almost more claustrophobic than 4:3. So it's not widescreen. It's basically shot the way Fritz Lang shot M in 1931. And so do not be confused when you see this in the movie theater that it is not widescreen. That's the way it was meant to be. They went back to some old Kodak film stock, he and his cinematographer, Janusz Blaszki, and they have really kind of captured a film that looks like no other film you're going to see this year. I like this movie a lot. It's definitely in my top five of the year so far. I would liken it to if Roman Polanski directed a film about a short story from Joseph Conrad. That's kind of what it feels like. It also feels like an Ingmar Bergman film. I mentioned Fritz Lang. It feels like a silent film in parts where there's long stretches of no talking. Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe play two lighthouse keepers. Defoe is the old salty dog, and Pattinson is the new guy, and they're supposed to be out there for 4 weeks. This takes place late 1800s near the coast of Maine, and it goes longer than 4 weeks due to a variety of things. Their relationship is really what the film is about. Who's crazy? Who's not crazy? What's real? What isn't real? And that's what the audience has to try to figure out. The two men have this uneasy relationship, and it's basically a test to see who goes insane first. This is as different and striking a film as you're going to find this year. I found both performances to be phenomenal. Robert Pattinson is way past Twilight. This is a physical performance he gives. He's fantastic in the role. Defoe, who is on such a roll lately with back-to-back Oscar nominations, at first when you hear him talk, you're like, is he acting from a film in the 1940s? He's chewing the scenery. He sounds like a combination of Captain Ahab and Robert Newton's wildly overplayed Long John Silver in the old Disney Treasure Island. But eventually, in his hands, it all comes off fine. He speaks in kind of an old language. Eggers has taken language from the time. There's some old sea shanties they talk about. And some of the language people they'll use in the film, just like in The Witch, is going to fall on deaf ears with modern audiences. But some of it was taken from actual, you know, words and how people spoke at that time. So that's an interesting part of it as well. Like I said, there's long stretches of no talking. It's always going to be discussed, I think, with this film, what is real and what is not real. Pattinson has some dream sequence scenes that are just phenomenally well edited, Doug. They're like you're watching a silent film by Abel Gance or Fritz Lang. And, you know, what's real and what isn't real is really at the heart of this film. But if you go in with an open mind, this is essentially an experimental film with two major stars attached to it.
Yeah, there are only three people in the movie, mm-hmm. and one of them, I think, is dead.
One's a mermaid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is a star turn for both of them, really.
It really is. This is a two-hander. It really is dependent on the two actors. The cinematography is fantastic. Like I said, you feel like you're watching a silent film until Defoe starts talking loudly. Pattinson plays the more reserved of the two. He's trying to escape a past that he's had. He wants to be inside the lighthouse, but Defoe protects that top lighthouse like it's his. He's not going to train him. Pattinson is shoveling stuff and shoveling coal and doing all kinds of menial tasks, and Defoe won't let him up in that lighthouse, and that becomes a plot point as well to keep your eye on.
Well, I was really intrigued reading about this, about what you mentioned, the sort of the old-fashioned approach to the cinematography. Mm-hmm. They used a lens that was over 100 years
old. That's right, yeah.
And so it's a square as opposed
to
this
square.
Long rectangle we're used to now. And this regional accent business. Mm-hmm. You know, when I grew up, I had an aunt from the Mississippi Delta. My mother from Tennessee had to subtitle her. That's how difficult it used to be for people in different parts of the country to understand each other.
Yeah, Pattinson is easier to understand than Defoe, I will say. And, you know, maybe subtitles might have helped. You're just going to have to really listen carefully. This is a film that does require some work from the audience. I know some people don't like that. But when I went to it, there were young people there, and that could be because of Pattinson's twilight past. He's still getting young people in the theater to see him go completely berserk on screen, which is fascinating to watch. But like I said, yes, the accents are interesting. The language is interesting. But to me, it all adds to you're watching something you're not going to see this year. Robert Eggers, in two films, has established himself as a unique director in modern cinema. There's nobody else doing the things like he's doing. He's basically making experimental films, and it's already made $3 million at the box office, which is very high. Its per-screen average is very high. That's very high for a film like this, and I do think it has some Oscar legs. I'm already hearing that they're going to push Defoe and Pattinson. They're going to push the cinematography. Robert Eggers as director. We'll have to see how the rest of the year shapes out, but this is right up there with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Joker, Midsommar, Us, some of the better films I've seen this year.
I want to see this movie, mm-hmm. and I'm intrigued by Willem Dafoe has been nominated several times.
Yeah.
So, twice
recently.
And so this might be the magic year. We'll see.
We'll see. They'll both be in the lead performance. That makes it, you know, interesting, but we'll see what happens. But I would recommend this. Check your listings. I saw it at the Fargo Theater. It is making the rounds now in more wide release.
All right. Here is our Academy Awards trivia question for this week. There are three motion pictures that have won Best Picture, Best Direction, Best Screenplay, Best Actress and Actor.
It Happened One Night, 1934, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975, Silence of the Lambs, 1991.
Well, that didn't take much time, did it? We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
On the next Radio Lab, 4 haunting tales.
I look over at the window, and there's this face.
The face of the young drowned woman was beautiful, that smiled as though it knew.
And I feel that tremor or buzz that something bad's about to happen.
Ghost stories.
The people who believe win. The skeptics lose.
On the next Radio Lab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 8th. North Dakota remembers Teddy Roosevelt, marking 100 years since his passing, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. Collegiate football has always been a contact sport, But in its early days, which began in the late 1870s, it was particularly deadly. The game had not developed the forward pass, and there was regular fighting, with fists thrown. Scoring was mostly made by kicking the football to the goal. Bones were snapped, eyes were gouged, and men were even killed. Flimsy equipment, leather helmets, and mere sweaters were little protection for the players, many of them illegally hired by colleges. Despite the mayhem, blood, and disorder, the game had a strong fan base, which included President Theodore Roosevelt. T.R. loved the game. All four of his sons had played. In 1905, the president knew there had been at least 18 deaths on the field. Continuance of the sport was on the line when T.R. met at the White House with the presidents of Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. T.R. threatened football's future if it were not reformed. That crew of educators and others devised a plan to retool the dangerous game through tighter rules of play, better uniforms and helmets, and more honorable officials. Many claim that Theodore Roosevelt helped save football.
One of the things I wish we could learn is how to make the game of football a rather less homicidal pastime. I do not speak as a sentimentalist, but I do not think that killing should be the normal accompaniment of the game. I would not have football abolished for anything, but I want to have it changed, just because I want to draw the teeth of the men who always clamor for the abolition of any manly game. I wish to deprive those whom I put in the mollycoddle class of any argument against any good sport.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Hi, I'm Jay Allison with the Moth Radio Hour. We're thrilled to bring the Moth Main Stage live storytelling event to the Fargo Theater. That's Thursday, November 14th. We hope you'll come hear some amazing stories from seasoned tellers and emerging talents. It's a fun and unpredictable evening. The Moth Main Stage Show. True stories, no notes. Thursday, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets at jadepresents.com.
Monday is Veterans Day. We'll look at how the home front helped in times of war. In an excerpt from the Dakota Journalist podcast, newspaper journalists will talk about their role to keep the public informed. And gardening is a peaceful activity, but it played an important role in both world wars. Marcus Kruger with the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County will explain why on Main Street on Monday. We hope you'll join us for that, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.